You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum found that for the second year in a row, the life expectancy of Wisconsinites is declining. We'll talk to a public health expert to find out what's behind that change. First, for 2020 presidential candidates, one issue is going to be a fixture in next year's campaign, and that's health care. It dominated last year's midterm elections, and now 2020 Democratic candidates are embracing a spectrum of changes, from Medicare for all to ideas like a public option. But our next guest says the debate is missing the mark on health care and not focusing on what's important to most Americans, cutting the costs of health care, no matter who's paying the bill. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel is the Vice Provost for Global Initiatives and Chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Emanuel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Nice to be here.
We'll talk about this this focus we have in the healthcare debate. It seems like it's a lot about who's paying for the coverage, individuals, businesses, the government, not on the cost itself.
Yeah, first of all, we shouldn't trivialize, you know, how we structure the payment and the financing of healthcare and whether the government's involved and whether employers are involved and how much each group pays. That is important. And one of the problems in America is it's pretty complicated whether you're eligible for Medicare or Medicaid or private employer-sponsored insurance. But I think at this moment, when we're sort of close to about 90% of the population with coverage, and we've made big gains, 20 million people getting coverage through the Affordable Care Act, increasingly the problem is affordability. And we see a lot of Americans who, I've got insurance, but I'm still worried that I won't be able to afford the deductible, or I'm still worried about the size of my a visit to the emergency room. And we've certainly had a lot of media reports about, you know, bills from the emergency room for a simple thing like stitches running thousands and thousands of dollars that make people, I think, very worried. And then there's, of course, the ever-present drug costs, which is really bothering people. And, you know, as I have said, 290 million Americans have coverage, 295 million, something in that range. And those people are worried about how much it's costing. And that's a big swath of the American public. And we need a strategy for getting our arms around the ever-increasing healthcare costs.
You wrote about these issues in a recent opinion piece. And one of the points you make was, as you just mentioned, the cost of prescription drugs. How do we look when it comes to our drug costs compared to other comparable developed countries?
Fat and bloated. The fact of the matter is that on a per-person basis, the United States spends nearly $1,500 per person on drugs. And our next closest country is at about $940 per person in drugs. And let me be clear with your listeners. That's not because Americans are taking lots of drugs and other people are much more prudent about the drugs they take. We certainly take fewer drugs than a lot of people in other countries. It's notable that we probably on a per person basis are somewhat less than other countries. It's all about the price of our drugs. Our drugs are priced very high. I'm just in the midst of completing a book called Which Country Has the World's Best Healthcare System? And one of the things you do if you go around to other developed countries is note that all of them regulate drug prices in some way. And the United States is the singular standout in that we give drug companies monopolies through patent protection, through FDA marketing exclusivity, and then we let them set the prices. We know there's good economic theory and good economic practice. We know where that leads when you give someone a monopoly, just ever higher prices. And so that's what we see in the drug market.
The argument there is always, okay, yeah, they make a lot of money doing it, but that money incentivizes drug companies to develop new and hopefully useful drugs.
Yeah, that's the argument. There's not a whole lot of great proof about it. So the first thing to recognize for your listeners, again, is that if you take a dollar at a drug company, less than 20 cents of that dollar goes to research and development of new drugs. That means 80 cents is going to other stuff ahead of the amount of money that they spend on research and development is on average across all the drug companies marketing and getting doxed to write prescriptions and getting patients to demand medications. Ahead of that is also profits. Drug companies are among the most profitable sectors, economic industries there are. They're more profitable on average than the 10 most profitable drug companies are more profitable than the big banks and the big tech companies. So there's plenty of money in that sector to do other things, and it's partially a decision by the drug companies. You know, I love them saying, look, it's a high-risk business. A lot of these things fail, and it is true. A lot of the stuff or the drugs that they bring to human trials won't make it in the end, but it can't be that high risk if they're walking away one after another with 20 to 25% profit margins.
Talking to doctors.
That defies risk.
Talking to Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel from the University of Pennsylvania, he makes the case that we need to do a lot to lower the costs of healthcare here in the United States. Before we move on from drugs, are you calling for an end to that system of monopolies? People have talked about better negotiations in Medicare and elsewhere. What would help bring those prices down?
So I think, first of all, you know, we're not going to end monopolies. We're not going to end the patent system. We don't want the FDA to stop reviewing drugs and giving marketing exclusivity. But we do want to say that doesn't mean you can charge whatever you want. As I said, every other developed country has some mechanism for regulating drug prices, whether they say, all right, let's look at what other countries are charging, and that will establish a maximal price for our country. Let's look at value-based pricing and look at the health benefits we're getting from this that drug. That'll relate, that'll establish a price for the drug. So we have to adopt some way of negotiating prices with drug manufacturers using external criteria, like what other countries charge, like how much health is improved for the drug. It does seem a little crazy to be spending, say, $100,000 on a cancer drug that prolongs life a few weeks or a few months. That just doesn't seem like the right kind of ratio. Again, putting it into context of what the average American earns. You know, what I like to say is, look, the average income for an American household is about $60,000 per year, right? Having a drug that prolongs life for a couple of months at $100,000 or $120,000 seems out of whack and defies common sense. Finally, I would remind everyone on who's listening is that we all pay for drugs. When I go to the pharmacy and get a drug and it's covered by my insurance, even if I'm paying a lot of it, right, the other parts are coming from insurance, which means your fellow Americans are actually paying, helping you pay the bill for that expensive drug. So we all have an interest in keeping drug costs under control, even if we ourselves are not taking drugs and not expending $100,000 on a drug. We're actually paying for someone else's drugs, and we need to be concerned about drug prices, even if we're not on those super expensive drugs.
Another place you find room for savings is in the cost of a hospital visit, especially under private insurance, or I guess out-of-pocket payments. What do you see there?
Well, so, you know, Medicare and Medicaid tell hospitals what they're going to pay for a hospital stay. If you get a, you know, heart bypass surgery, if you get a hip replacement, Medicare says, here's what it is, hospital. You're covering the whole visit, and here's how much we're paying you. That's not true on the private side for private insurance. There's a negotiation, and over the last more than a decade, we've seen a lot of hospital consolidation, the formation of big hospital systems. And the main motivation there, while hospitals often say, you know, we're more efficient, actually most of the data suggests that it leads to higher prices because they have local monopolies. And again, they use their monopoly power to negotiate higher rates from the insurers. So if you say, wow, my premiums are going way up, you ought to ask the next question. Why are the premiums going way up? Is it because the profit margin of the insurance companies are that high? The answer to that is probably not. It's because their costs are high, and a major factor in their costs, about a third of the hospital, a third of insurance costs and healthcare costs go to hospitals, and that's high hospital costs are a major driver of high premiums. Between high drug prices and high hospital costs, you have a big, big driver of the increase in premiums. And, you know, hospitals have been, you know, gobbling up other hospitals in order to increase their negotiating leverage.
Talking to Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, Vice Provost for Global Initiatives, Chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania, looking at the costs of healthcare, not just who's covering those costs, but how to lower them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about how this could work, how we could save money overall in our healthcare system? What do you think about some of the ideas you've heard so far? Would you support these kind of efforts? Do you want to hear candidates talking about them as they run for president or U.S. Senate, say? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Also, if you work in healthcare, do you see room for cost savings in your line of work? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about making healthcare more affordable. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel is with us from the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to hear presidential candidates talking about when it comes to the cost of healthcare? What ideas have gotten you the most excited? Do you see room for better cost savings in our healthcare system? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Emanuel, we were just talking about the cost of hospital visits. You were talking about, in effect, monopolies at hospitals. What would you see as a solution? How would you want to bring those costs down?
So I do think that there's two solutions. One is we need a bit better enforcement of antitrust and focusing really on local monopolies of hospitals. And I think in general, there's been a view that we haven't had sufficient antitrust activity and aggressive enforcement of those standards in the United States. Outside of healthcare and certainly inside of healthcare, there are obviously complex cases to bring, but I think we need a lot more clarity about the standards. And again, in healthcare, especially looking at local micro monopolies rather than, you know, statewide monopolies and things like that, because healthcare is local. People don't travel hundreds of miles typically unless they're in very rural areas for their healthcare. That's one thing. Another thing is we could legislate maximal prices that hospitals can charge private insurance. So you could say you can't charge more, as I suggested, than 140% of Medicare for the service. And I think that setting a maximal price would be effective. We have seen over the last 20 years hospital prices for the private sector, again, private insurance, go up much, much more rapidly than the prices for Medicare. And I think that needs to be controlled.
Let's bring on a caller now. Paula is with us in La Crosse. Paula, hi.
Oh, hi. I've been in healthcare for 33 years, and I've really seen it getting better the last 10 years in regards to our end-of-life care and, you know, really focusing on getting people's primary care providers to have advanced directives and what people want and palliative care. But I still see, you know, a lot of cost. And I know you mentioned about, like, for example, the cost of a chemotherapy drug when, you know, life expectancy. So just curious, the statistic, is that getting better?
That's a great question. It's an area I've worked on since the mid-1980s, trying to improve end-of-life care in our country. So what do we know about the cost of end-of-life care? About 0.75%, so less than 1% of Americans die each year. And we spend about 8.5 to 10% of all healthcare spending goes to that 0.75% of Americans. So it is relatively very expensive. They're 10 times the average person, and we know the closer you are to death, the much higher the costs are. There are many, many things we can do, as you point out. Don't do the last chemotherapy. You know, we know that 10% of all cancer patients get chemotherapy inside the last 30 days of life. That doesn't seem like, you know, it's not hard to predict when the last 30 days or when you're close to the end. We know that about 40% of cancer patients end up in the ICU in the last 6 months of life. So there are lots of things that could be done. In general, we have done better in cancer at getting patients hospice care, and that has actually a majority of cancer patients at the end of life do get hospice care. We could do more of that, and not just for cancer patients. In addition, most of us who work in the area think we need to move upstream. We need to, you know, well before the last month or 2 months of life, really begin talking and getting patients more home care, getting them comfortable being in the home, getting them more services so they will stay in the home and not pop into the hospital where expenses really go dramatically higher. Interestingly, in the last few years, there have been a number of companies that have begun trying to adopt some of these new techniques to improve palliative care and to keep patients at home and give them more services at home. And so I think we're going to have some interesting efforts to do that. And, you know, when I started 30 years ago, there was no idea that we would, you know, have this widespread social acceptance of trying to improve end-of-life care to reduce the cost and improve the quality and keep patients at home. And I think that's one of the positive signs I see in end-of-life care is the fact that we're now much more frank about trying to do what you said, which is, you know, not do the heroic interventions keep patients comfortable and with their family.
Paula, thanks for the call. We're talking to Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel from the University of Pennsylvania about bringing down the costs of health care. Back to your calls. Michael is with us now in Mequon. Michael, hi.
Hi, Dr. Emanuel. It's great to hear your views on these things.
Thank you.
In reading about health care in other countries, some of the things that hit me are that we probably should have a health czar who can work with the states and also sort of look at rationalizing how you use health resources and which mergers do you approve and where do you need more competition maybe and more do you need less competition. One of the big things it seems to me also is that we have to change the way we deliver care. The cost of care itself has to be reduced because that overlies everything else. And we hear, you know, the medical literature talks about it, but in the popular literature, in the popular press, we don't hear a lot about how one can redesign care to reduce our costs.
Michael, thanks for the call. And Dr. Emanuel, you talk about this in that piece I referenced on the incentives for healthcare providers.
That, your listener, just put into an area that I've been working on for a long time and I'm really focused on now, which is, you know, in the end, doctors and nurses and nurse practitioners, they end up, you know, giving a lot of the medicine, ordering tests, ordering treatments, and changing their incentives and changing how they provide care and approach the care process is important. And to do that, we need to move off what we call the fee-for-service system, where we pay people to do various activities, and we need to pay in a much different way. We need to bundle and say, all right, all that hip replacement, whether it's the surgery or the rehabilitation or the radiology or it's the implant, all of that is one price. We're paying you for the entire care, not each slice. Similarly, we can change and pay primary care doctors, pediatricians, and internists, and we can say, you know what? We're going to pay you per patient a set fee every month, and you're going to be incentivized to keep them healthy and not to spend unnecessarily on them. We know that the healthcare system in the United States, like many other healthcare systems, has a lot of unnecessary services. Those are, we do a test, even though it's not going to be good for the patient, it's not going to improve their health, or we give them a treatment, and there is a cheaper treatment, a cheaper drug, or a cheaper radiation treatment or a cheaper surgery that would have made a big difference. And we've got to get those unnecessary services, those inefficiently delivered services, out of the system. And that is very important. And the only way we're going to get doctors to and hospitals to focus on that is to change how we pay them so that they don't make more money by doing more things. That is a very silly system to incentivize efficiency. So having a set fee for a whole set of activities is probably much more important. And if doctors are at risk, they might actually focus much more on keeping people healthy and on wellness rather than just attend to patients when they become sick. So this shift in how we pay and the financial incentives, I think, is the long-term solution to the affordability of healthcare.
Michael, thanks a lot for that call. And just our last minute, I want to touch on one more problem area you point out in your opinion piece, what you call wasteful insurance billing practices. What are we seeing?
Yeah, everyone knows the typical thing. Thousands of people at insurance companies, thousands of people at hospitals, processing bills, and the bills are never right, and they're very expensive, and they add a lot to the cost. And it's true. A large portion of healthcare costs are bill processing. We need to have a system that is more standardized, that has a central clearinghouse, just like ATMs. And it is complicated in healthcare, but we can do a lot to standardize the processes and standardize the clearinghouse efforts behind the scenes and reduce the number of people who actually process that paperwork. I think we have to get there. I know that there are, a number of new startup companies focusing on that, and I'm mildly optimistic with some government leadership we can actually make that happen.
Dr. Emanuel, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. My pleasure. And this is an important issue, and I'm sure your audience is, you know, really does care about it because it affects their paycheck and their wallets.
That's Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, the Vice Provost for Global Initiatives and Chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. He's with us today to talk about why he wants to hear presidential candidates talking not just about health care coverage, but on also cutting the costs of delivering health care to Americans. Coming up, the projected life expectancy for babies born in Wisconsin has declined for the second year in a row. We'll learn what factors are adding to that shortened life expectancy and maybe how to turn those numbers around. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on the morning show, listen for the plaintive cry of the loon. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the unique species that captures the attention of bird watchers and bird listeners. It's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, for the second year in a row, research finds that the life expectancy for newborns in Wisconsin is inching downward. The projected average age for a baby born today is 80 years old. That's down from 80.1 a couple years back. 80.2 just before that. Those changes are pretty small, but they suggest that long trends of increasing life expectancy are tapering off. The report attributes this to a number of issues, including alcohol and opioid use and rising suicide rates. Our next guest is here to break down the data and talk about what policies could maybe change the course. Dr. Patrick Remington is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Population Health Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Patrick, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back. Thanks.
Well, seeing these numbers here in Wisconsin, it seems to fit in with a lot of what we've talked about before when we look at national numbers. How does this all fit together?
Yeah, there are two different trends in the nation and in Wisconsin in changes in death rates. We've seen steady declines in the death rates due to leading causes of death like heart disease, stroke, and even cancer. But there have been increases in the causes of death that occur predominantly in young people. Opioid overdose, suicide, deaths related to alcohol abuse and misuse. So they're really two different trends. And because the increasing death rates in young people have overtaken the progress that we see, the continued progress of declining death rates in older people, so that life expectancy on average is now declining.
Right. It should be absent to those causes of death younger in life, the addiction, the suicide. This should be a time of celebration. We're really putting a dent in what have for years been the leading causes of death in the United States, right?
Well, over the last century, life expectancy has increased 25 years. And virtually all of that has been due to advances in major public health advances, eliminating or significantly reducing causes of childhood death, and then reducing the leading causes of death, heart disease and stroke predominantly.
Smoking or reducing smoking, I imagine, is part of that story.
We've cut smoking rates in half over the last 50 years, and smoking-related cancers have been declining in men for about 15 years and women just in the last 5 or 10 years.
So there's all that good news, but we're seeing the rates of death because of addiction, alcohol, suicide, enough to overcome, or to start to turn the tide on those gains and move the needle downward again.
Yeah, and these are not just slight increases in deaths related to opioids and suicide and alcohol abuse. These are dramatic increases. These are threefold, four, fivefold increases. In some areas, they've gone up tenfold. And according to the report we just saw on your website, Wisconsin is leading the nation in some of these increases, particularly in Milwaukee County.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from UW-Madison, looking at mortality trends here in Wisconsin and around the country. Let's talk about that. In Milwaukee County, the report talked about deaths because of opioid addiction-related issues. A lot of the talk recently about opioids has focused on rural America, and that's true. Things are happening there, but it's kind of overshadowed what's also going on in urban areas. What do we see in Milwaukee County?
Well, the major finding is that no group, no race, region, or gender is spared from this epidemic. There have been greater increases predominantly in whites in rural America, but the increases, you're talking about a fivefold increase as opposed to a fourfold increase. So I think the major take-home message is this is an epidemic that has really taken hold in nearly every sector of society, urban, rural, rich and poor, white and black.
I saw some numbers pretty recently that said, okay, for the first time in the most recent data year, I don't remember if it was 2017 or 18, we saw the number of overdose deaths go down in Wisconsin for the first time in a few years. Is that a sign of hope or just maybe a statistical blip?
No, I think it is a sign of hope because the rates were leveling off and now begin to decline. Again, that's after a significant increase. Mm-hmm. So we're clearly not yet out of the woods. But it's typical of many large public health problems. They brew really for decades, the lung cancer epidemic and the smoking epidemic of the 1960s. We didn't see that turn in the death statistics until the 1990s. And we still see 300 or 400,000 people die from smoking every year. So that problem hasn't gone away, but it's been significantly reduced. And I think you'll see the same thing with opioid and deaths and suicide, is that we may begin to understand the causes and maybe putting effective programs into place. But it's just going to turn the numbers very slightly. We're nowhere near where we need to be.
So opioid deaths and suicide, you just said, lump in alcohol there, which we'll talk about separately in a few moments. But you've talked to me in the past about, I think you call it diseases of despair.
Yeah, there's no question that a common element of this epidemic of opioid and alcohol and drug-related deaths is that people have despair, that people have mental health issues, and it's related to challenges in educational opportunities and jobs and low-income jobs, not being able to access effective and accessible mental health services. And so the causes are multitude, but the effect is that there's despair. And readily available pain medicines, either legally prescribed or illegally obtained on the street, is a way for the population really to treat the pain. And by doing so, it's a solution, it's a quick solution, a short-term solution that leads to tremendous problems down the road. And eventually, overdose deaths are the result.
check me on this to see if this is a fair assessment. It seems like in the last few years, we've done a lot to address that supply issue, trying to cut back on the amount of opioids that get prescribed. Of course, drug interdiction efforts targeting fentanyl and other drugs coming across our borders. That seems to get a lot of attention. Is there enough attention on the other half of the equation you just mentioned, that mental health access, mental health care access to help people with that underlying despair that might lead them to reach for the opioids in the first place?
I think complex problems like the opioid epidemic and suicide require complex solutions. We should take care of the simple things first. And clearly, prescribing practices were out of control. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a monitoring system. People were able to get access to pain meds when they didn't need them. And so we've started to fix that problem. But that doesn't – that's really almost a symptom of the despair and the reason people seek these substances. And suicide, again, readily available ways, lethal means to kill oneself, firearms predominantly for men. So that's one potential solution, but we need to understand ways to address the root causes, the reason that people have despair, the reason that people have mental health issues. And so, again, let's do the simple things first. But then move on to understanding the root causes and starting to address those.
We'll get into that a little more. I want to turn to alcohol for a minute. Opioids all over the headlines the last few years. I don't think that's a surprise to people that we're seeing more deaths because of that. Alcohol, I think here in Wisconsin, we think, yeah, we might have a problem with alcohol. We've always had a problem. But it sounds like, do I have this right, alcohol-related deaths are increasing.
Yeah, and again, alcohol-related deaths from alcohol poisoning and long-term alcohol abuse are increasing. Motor vehicle crashes related to alcohol are also increasing. So many of these public health problems have solutions, but the minute you, in effect, take your foot off the accelerator and stop addressing them, they come back. So we did a great job of reducing alcohol-related motor vehicle crashes through enforcement and through prevention programs, but that will undoubtedly come back as use patterns change and as public health priorities shift.
As use patterns change, are we drinking more?
We're not really drinking more. It's really a question of problem drinking. So Wisconsin leads the nation in per capita alcohol consumption, but also leads the nation in binge drinking. So, there's alcohol is clearly a substance that we can't ban. That was we tried that 80 years ago, and it didn't work. But it's a substance that needs to be controlled, and we need to look at reducing problem drinking behavior.
Do we in Wisconsin acknowledge that we have a problem with binge drinking? A comment that sticks with me from years ago when we did a segment about binge drinking, looked at the statistics and said, oh, well, if you call five or six nights in a binge or five or six drinks in one night a binge, well, of course, we all binge drink, as though that was like the normal level.
Yeah. Many problems like binge drinking and high rates of alcohol consumption in Wisconsin are deeply embedded in our culture. And people from Wisconsin don't even realize that it is a public health problem. You can get alcohol in our student union. There are many colleges across the country where that wouldn't be possible. You get alcohol at the end of most athletic events and fun runs. Right here, the Crazy Legs run. Alcohol is served just across the finish line. That's normative for Wisconsin and for our community. And so that's deeply embedded in our culture. And so that you need to think about not just, the specific problem drinkers, but how deeply that pattern is in culture that everybody experiences.
We're talking to Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus of the Department of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison. He's with us to talk about a new report on life expectancy in Wisconsin showing a slight decline over the last few years, in part, large part, because of alcohol, opioids, and suicide. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about life expectancy in Wisconsin? Do you see opioids, alcohol, suicide being a big factor, a big problem in your community, maybe in your life? What should we do to change things when it comes to binge drinking in the state, to opioid addictions? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about a new report that finds for the second year in a row the life expectancy for Wisconsinites is going down. This is after decades where our life expectancy in the nation was going up. The causes related to alcohol, opioids, and suicide for the most part. Dr. Patrick Remington is with us, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We were just talking about the culture of drinking and binge drinking in Wisconsin. Do you see that where you live? What do you think we can do to turn that around, to stop us from drinking in dangerous quantities and dangerous situations? Do you see the opioid epidemic having an impact in your community? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Patrick, let's get back to mental health care and coverage in Wisconsin. You're talking about that as maybe the longer term solution to a lot of these problems. What do we have? Where do we need to get?
Well, mental health services have for a long time been outside of the traditional health care realm. We, for decades, had a cap on mental health services that when you reached a certain amount, I think it was $10,000, that was a lifetime cap for mental health care. Clearly, that's not a health care system that thinks about getting good outcomes from people who have a brain disease. So we've clearly turned the corner on providing insurance coverage for people with mental health services. But insurance coverage isn't enough. We need more providers, and we need better access to those providers, a better entry system from primary care to mental health care. And you talk to people who try and navigate the mental health care service system that we have, and it's very challenging. There are long delays. People aren't able to get into the system when they need to. And so we just need to fix the problem with a poor supply of mental health providers and accessible health care so that it's where people live and work and can access that care.
Do we know what works for someone who might have both an underlying mental health concern and an addiction problem, whether it's alcohol or opioids or something else?
Well, we have evidence-based programs. There's clearly health care services and treatment protocols that work for people with either addiction problems or mental health problems or both. They're obviously not perfect. They don't work all the time, but they work for many patients. But what doesn't work is that if people aren't accessing those evidence-based services. So the most important thing is to improve the evidence through research and finding programs that work and policies that can help provide funding. But then the other thing is to actually get people into care by having more care available.
And I've heard sometimes even from callers, I was able to get access to treatment for 30 days or 60 days.
Yeah, again, it's not a complete wraparound service. And the frustrating thing is that if you had a coronary artery bypass or if you have cancer, there's no question that that care is going to be there when you need it, and it's going to be there for the entire course of treatment. We just treat mental health services and mental health care differently. We have this idea that it should be short term and that people don't have a chronic disease. And it's clearly a chronic illness that needs to be cared for over the life course. And that is a culture change. We need to take away the stigma from having mental illness so that people can access it freely. Most people who commit suicide, most people who overdose have expressed that need for care in the past. And it's just, you know, if you don't pay attention to what people need, eventually problems result.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Eric is with us in Springer. Eric, hi. Nope. Eric's gone. He wanted to say it seems like it could be easier to get opioids than, say, less harmful substances out there. Have we made it less easy for people to access opioids?
There's some talk about the pendulum swinging too far to make it very difficult. And I was just talking with Dr. John Tempty, the Associate Dean for Public Health now in the School of Medicine and Public Health. And as a clinician, he found that if people who needed opioids had trouble getting them, that they often resorted to illegal means. And those can be deadly. So that you need to have a balance of not providing opioids when they're not needed, but when they're needed to provide it in a very careful way in a care system with a close relationship with your primary care provider.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from UW-Madison, looking at a report showing life expectancy going down over time in the last few years here in Wisconsin after years of increases, largely related to things like alcohol, opioid, drug addiction, and suicide. We've talked about the numbers when it comes to alcohol and opioids. What's happening with suicide numbers, Patrick?
Well, again, suicide is a symptom of mental health problems. And so what we've seen with young rates of suicide is that rates are going up, particularly in people living in rural areas. And you also see sort of two ends of the spectrum. Suicide rates are higher in older men. And again, the common element is that people have expressed problems. There's been almost always some message that people are having challenges and are depressed, but that message doesn't come through. And there are times when care is provided and an individual will eventually commit suicide despite everything you do. And families who have struggled with this know this is the case, that you do everything you can and still an individual takes their life. But many more times there are people who just don't get the care, don't have the support that they need. And so the key is to understand when individuals are hurting that they need care and you need to talk about it more, not less.
A caller who can't come on the air with us says she's a licensed mental health provider. It's a scarce resource, especially in her part of the state. And there's a societal unwillingness to put enough resources into mental health care.
It's a longstanding stigma. In fact, we call it mental health. In a way, we don't want to talk about mental disease or mental disorders. We don't mind talking about cancer and heart disease as diseases, but we have the sense that we should just talk about mental health issues and mental health treatment. It is a disorder and a disease, and it needs treatment. And we have 20, 30, 50 years of stigma so that we don't treat it as a mental health condition, as a health condition. And we don't provide the provider network that is needed, particularly as the caller or the listener said, in rural and underserved areas.
Is part of the problem that there's often a moral stigma attached to things like addiction and maybe even suicide, that there is a moral judgment being made that might cloud our public health judgment?
There's absolutely a moral judgment. It's viewed as a moral failing that somebody who has an addiction problem, it's true in obesity, that we feel that this is not a disease, that it's a problem with a weak moral or personal character. And that's clearly not the case. So that we really need to understand the root causes, understand that individuals have a role in their own care, but they can't do it alone. And that's when a care team and having the right professionals in place in communities makes the difference.
All right, so we've got this study, this number that is definitely worrisome. Life expectancy is going down. What are you watching for in the future to see if we bend the arc back the other way?
Well, one thing is to make sure that reports like this continue, and not just for the nation and not just for Wisconsin, but every community can look at their own reports. We do a county health rankings in at the university, and each year communities can look at how their health is determined. And so community by community should look at this problem, because the solutions in Milwaukee County are going to be different than the solutions in Menominee County or Marinette. So that's clearly the approach that works the best, is to understand the problem in your community, understand what resources you have, and then look for ways to bring those resources to bear to address the issue.
Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Patrick Remington is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison. He joined us today to talk about the latest report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum that found life expectancy in the state going down in large part because of alcohol, opioids, and suicide. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, play ball and play a little faster. Our guest says professional sports have a time problem. They take too darn long. Find out why and share your thoughts. Democratic presidential candidates talked about Native American issues this week in North Dakota. A Wisconsin tribal leader joins the show for a look at political priorities for Native Americans in the state and around the country. And we'll find out what happened when a Wisconsin bar owner took down a wall and found an unexpected historical artifact. That and a look at some of the top news in national politics. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, Don't You Forget About Me, and don't forget about the teen movies of the 1980s. Kate and her guests look back at The Breakfast Club, Footloose, and other movies that shaped my generation, for better or worse. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then Wisconsin is joining a nationwide effort to reduce elder abuse. We'll check out the problem and find out what works to prevent it. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.